The NHS is facing big challenges. The service is top of the list of concerns by the public and therefore by the government. The budget last autumn gave the NHS more priority than almost everything else. And in a very tight fiscal climate, the NHS was awarded about the normal average growth in resources over at least the next 2 years. But given all that, things are still very tight. The pressure is now on to construct the 10-year plan due this spring. And it can't just be any old plan, but a plan that can step up to the huge challenges and opportunities ahead. So what should be in it? With me to discuss all this, I'm pleased to have two guests. Nigel Edwards, my colleague of many years and formerly the chief executive at the Nuffield Trust, and my colleague here at the Health Foundation, Dr. Hugh Alderwick, director of policy. Welcome both. Clearly, we've had long-term plans before. We've had the NHS plan in 2000. We've had the five-year forward view in 2014 and the long-term plan in 2019. Nigel, can you just tell us a little bit about what you think we've got to learn from these previous exercises?
Yes, indeed. I think we've really lacked any sort of real theory of change in any of the plans that we've had before. And in fact, the 2000 plan, they had to really scrabble over the subsequent years to invent payment by results, foundation trust, and a number of instruments to try and make the change happen. The second is they've really been typified by far too many priorities, sort of long shopping lists with no real sense of what's important. A third thing I feel is they've often neglected some quite important fundamentals, in particular, the importance of a really strong primary care platform on which you can build everything else. And I think increasingly the importance of social care to unlock some of the blockages that the system has. But the final lesson, I think, is that while the 2000 plan did make an effort to get everyone behind it, and we've had this consultation exercise now, I think there's too much of constructing these plans as we're in opposition to the professionals, and you know, our job at the government is to overcome these vested interests and Blair's rhetoric about scars on his back and Wes Streeting's more recent rhetoric about, you know, I'm here to represent the patients, not the providers. Successful reform really requires you to capture the creativity, imagination and enthusiasm of the frontline staff. And we're desperately missing that. And I think that a lesson here is more effort required to bring people with you rather than to construct conflicts that may not actually be there.
Three things to add to Nigel's. I think the context is almost just as important as the content of the plan. So if you think of NHS plan in 2000, Labour committed to big increases in NHS spending. The plan sort of showed how that would be spent. More doctors, nurses, beds, equipment, went alongside a bigger strategy on health inequalities. So a supportive context for making improvement. Compare that to the 2010s, you've got austerity in spending on the NHS, in other public services, you got cuts in public health. So the context was so different that really matters. We've got a bit of the 2000s and a bit of the 2010s right now. We've got some hope from a government that wants to reform the NHS, but really challenging economic context. I think, like Nigel said, the plans are sort of a starting point for reform. They're not the final word. So a lot of a new Labour's reform agenda came later, annual updates to the plan, things like payment by results. But I think the last is just the implementation has really varied. Often what gets written in the plan doesn't actually happen. Something totally different happens. So these are political and performative moments as much as they are policy ones. Also, who develops them matters. As you pointed out, in the 2010s, these plans came from arm's length, a bit outside government. They were almost written as levers to get some more cash out of the Treasury. And Simon Stevens was very successful at doing. In the 2000s, we knew there was lots of money coming. And the question was, how is the NHS going to spend it? So again, the timing matters here.
And can I just pick up something that Nigel said, which is this whole idea about having a theory of change that's coherent? Can you chart out for everyone listening why you think that is important? Because people can get their heads around priorities, you know, primary care or cardiology or pediatrics, but the theory of change often leaves people cold. Like, it's often page 103 in these reform plans. But just say why you think it's important, both of you.
Planning is relatively easy. Implementation is extremely hard. So we can specify what needs to be done. And if you look across different health systems, very often there's a list of quite similar things. The question is, how are you going to make this happen? How do you get large organisations to change? How are you going to get clinicians to change the way they operate? And quite a lot of that requires a mixed set of financial incentives, regulatory changes, hearts and minds and relationship building, skilled change management, quality improvement methods. There's a whole host of these things that need to be directed to get change happen. You cannot simply say, this is what I want to happen and expect that it will happen without some idea about what people will actually do on a Monday morning when they come to work that will be different from what they did before. And that bit often is not really paid very much attention at all.
What would you add there, Hugh?
If you look back at the recent plans, they've been so weak on how care will actually be improved. I mean, part of the job of a plan is to provide some hope, say what will be different, provide some vision of the future. But they often focus on that. And at the end, there might be some money, there might be some ingredients like payment reform, and the details will come later. And sometimes they come, sometimes they don't. And that's why you get a gap between the rhetoric and the reality. A good example is shifting care outside of hospital. All of these plans say we want to shift care outside of hospital, we want to boost primary care. They don't say how it happened, and it doesn't happen. And the reason it's difficult is because the NHS is super complex. So lots of interacting parts, often quite unpredictable ways. You pull one policy lever like a new target and something unexpected happens. So you need to have not just an idea of what you want to do with the payment system or what a new target might be for reducing the backlog. You've got to work out what your overall idea is for how the system improves and then align all those different levers together. So you need to have some ideas as well as a sort of flow chart and a set of arrows. And so when you look at the system now, there's some obvious areas that are running against the government's objectives, things like performance targets, while they're really focused on hospitals. The payment system is super complex. It's a mess. Quality regulation is sort of very publicly collapsing. But also, what's the engine for improvement when, you know, people in NHS Trust go to work? Will they have time? Will they have data? Will they have skills to actually change services? And that's, again, often missing. One thing is, what policy levers can you pull as a politician? I can move the organizations around. I can change the payment system. What is really lacking is, what are the skills for redesigning services that patients will receive differently? And can we provide them to the front line? That's things like capital investment, IT, skills for improving services, project managers. They're often quite boring things, and you don't really find them in these glossy documents about the next 5 years, the next 10 years. And it's fine if they come later, but they have to come at some point.
But presumably they can come later. And in a sense, it's impossible to think that anyone, whoever they are, can have the whole set of levers in concert, beautifully arranged in their head. But how would we better construct them than we've done before, which has been kind of reliant probably on a small number of individuals flying blind or influenced by a kind of prevailing ideology about what works. So how would we better move forwards?
Three things from my perspective. One, as a researcher would say this, we'd actually try and learn about what works. Surprisingly little attention to evaluation of massive reforms, particularly something on the NHS. We can reform across the whole system at once, and yet we often fail to evaluate what happened as a result. Some of the evaluation suggests it's more boring things, less competition and more money, resources that seem to make a difference. But one is, we test and evaluate. The second is, we'd look at what the current system is and try and build around it. So what do I mean by that? Well, right now, government's just set up these things called integrated care systems, which are area-based bodies that are trying to bring together money for the NHS, plan services in a coherent way. They exist now. There's people working for those organizations now. And you can either think, how do we support them to do a good job? Or you can have a big new idea and layer it on top. The first one is sensible, pragmatic, built on what you have. The second is ideological, silly, and will ultimately disrupt the system. So often we start from a blueprint as though nothing existed and we don't work with the system. And the third is, I think, focusing more on the people doing the change. So this is people at the front line to actually make change happen in an environment where there's not a lot of resources. So focusing on the skills, the capacity, the resources, staff in the NHS, social care, elsewhere actually need to do a good job, and starting there. I guess a bonus would have a guiding idea, which really helps stitch together these more technical, smaller policy changes. And this is often fashion as much as evidence, but it's really important to have an idea for how you think the NHS and public services will change. So in the 2000s, that's sort of new public management, the market. In the 2010s, the stated rules were about competition. The reality was, let's collaborate. It's not really very clear now what the government's idea is or the story is for how improvement will happen. And I think it matters a lot that that's missing.
even if you just take those three big plans, NHS plan, five-year forward view, and the long-term plan, in between those big moments, there were punctuated by quite significant other initiatives and reforms, shifting the balance of power. That was Patricia Hewitt. You've got the Lansley reforms in 2012. You know, you've got big other things going on in the middle that can swerve you off course into an unhelpful direction, often related to a change in government. I mean, clearly there may be a change in government in 5 years' time, who knows? But what we've got is quite significant technologies that could disrupt this pattern. So even more a greater need, what Nigel talks about, is a consensus that we all know what we're facing and there's some level of agreement.
Part of the issue here, I think, is the fact that these plans are really top down. To do predictable change at anything other than quite a macro level as a top down or policymaker is quite limited. If you want to be able to adapt to new technologies and external shocks, the ability of your local system to have a clear vision about what they're doing, the engagement of the clinicians who are going to deliver it, capable managers, you've got the tools and the capability and the bandwidth and time and space to do the change and to apply the methodologies that we know work. So the plans really ought to be much more about setting a small number of broad priorities and then creating an environment in which those local systems can evolve and adapt within the parameters that you've set. The more detail you set, the more likely you are going to be unable to deal with those external shocks. And also you soak up all of the bandwidth that people need to do their local improvements. I think I'd challenge the whole philosophy of these big, comprehensive, quasi-Stalinist, Shamashko, Soviet model plans in favour of something that if we look at Israel or the Netherlands or Denmark, and as we said, all of these countries have problems and don't implement all of their plans. Very few people ever do. But they do seem to be able to create something that's more about a shared sense of direction and then more space with some pressure and drivers to get people to change and create some grit in the oyster that makes people want to adapt. I think the danger of trying to specify not just what but how at high levels of detail saps the initiative from the system and removes the opportunity to have that sort of adaptability and change dynamic that you're going to need to be able to respond to particularly some of the technological and other challenges that are coming at us.
But just as a case to your point, if you think about the five-year forward view, there was pushed integrated care. And there was this, you know, we'll set a sort of broad framework, but we'll allow a lot of, you know, freedom within a framework to allow localities to adapt towards these ends. But with the new care models, I don't think that was a resounding success either, though, was it?
No, but then it suffered from the what the NHS leadership seemed to continue to suffer from, which is the St. Augustine problem of, give me devolution and local initiative, but oh Lord, but not yet. First of all, there are some things where you can say we are going to be very specific and we will determine this centrally. So, for example, Spain, which is 17 rather fractious autonomous communities, all use the same methodology for risk stratification across all 17 autonomous communities. There's probably more than 17 in London. You can go and buy Epic, but it doesn't talk to the NHS app, and that's apparently all right. And yet, if you want to employ a first contact physio, someone has specified how many hold time equivalents you need to one decimal point. So there's something about actually deciding what you're going to do centrally and what the decision rights are locally. And you don't let 1,000 flowers bloom in situations where you say, well, actually, no, your patient record system has to talk to the NHS app. Oh, no, you can't do that because the evidence is that will not work. We haven't worked out what you should specify and what you should allow for local discretion, where the decision rights sit in the system, and which problems you can apply a checklist, do this approach to, as opposed to this problem requires you to do experimental learning in your local situation. We're back to the theory of change problem, and it's related to that.
Hugh, what would you add here?
We have to accept that the NHS is a highly centralised system with a strong degree of central oversight, and these plans are going to be a feature of that sort of system. And so, as Nigel's saying, it's what's the balance of national top-down standards, what approach to change, and then how much flexibility locally. The problem is we've had a bunch of plans that have been sort of dishonest about that and said we're going to try and devolve more power, there's going to be more local autonomy, and at the same time they've probably gripped harder letting go while holding on type thing. The question is, essentially, can we name the things that need to be done once? We want an equitable system, so we've got to set out some standards that we think are fair. We've got to allocate resources fairly. We've got to invest in infrastructure. And we've got to do the other things around the NHS that help it work properly, like social care, which is not national enough in its approach, like public health. So we've got to put the other bits around it. I think we can't just wish for a different system. We have to face up to the one we have, but we've got to try and get a better balance of national and local and give the local bodies that we've set up some actual power. I worry that what's going to happen is that these integrated care boards that have been sort of set up to lead change locally are actually going to have less power, less autonomy to lead that change, and we might have a more fractured environment for making the plan happen.
Just say, though, there's a really good plan, right? And it's what we want to see. There's still the issue, which is the election coming up in 5 years' time. All these things could be blown off course. You can't bind future governments into any course of action. But is there anything more that could be done to encourage them to do that? For example, by helping develop greater consensus amongst all the major stakeholders, or what do you think?
Well, we've tried some of the things. So one answer you might expect is take some of the politics out of the decisions. Part of the landscape reforms aim to do that. And I don't think anybody would say that happened in practice. Another might be that you make some of the investment now that's longer term. So you try and set in motion some changes to infrastructure, like capital investment in IT, new data, new infrastructure, that it might be harder to unwind, although we've seen from big infrastructure projects that you can reverse them halfway through or towards the end of them. Another might be to try and, as you say, get consensus at least on what the knottiest questions are and what some solutions might be. Social care is a good example. But then the flip side is that could be an excuse not to change. You've got a government now with a big majority, a manifesto that said they would fix social care. And in the name of cross-party consensus, it might be 3 years before we have a solution. So there's drawbacks to all of them and limits on what can be done in practice.
If we just look at the case study of social care, where it's become a complete political football, we had Lansley derailing Andy Burnham's reforms and then Theresa May running into trouble with her dementia tax. Yeah, there's been a history of that. I mean, the Netherlands reform programme has managed, despite the fact it's quite, you know, politically, there's lots of little parties and but there is a sort of been since 2006 a general consensus about the broad lineaments of reform. I suppose the difference there is that the Dutch government doesn't run the health system. It creates the policy framework. Basically, we're the victim of Arjen Bevin making the wrong choice. If Herbert Morrison had won the argument, we might have some different problems, but I think they might not be quite so acute. I think the fact that the NHS is so tightly bound to what, if we're honest, is quite a dysfunctional political system, where the Secretary of State is a middle manager whose customer is the Treasury, and therefore, you know, the chance of being sort of patient and citizen focused, despite all the rhetoric, is quite low because it's of its salience. It's bound to be a political football. I'm quite pessimistic about the ability to get sort of anything other than very broad consensus. I mean, it's worth noting that reform quite explicitly would like to dismantle large elements of the NHS model. So we've got a growing bit of the political system that doesn't even sign up to the idea of having a solidarity-based NHS system, let alone being able to get people aligned on the broad principles of reform.
And yet the public are seemingly, are they not, rock solid on the National Health Service? Are they?
That's right. In the polling that we do, that others do, the British Social Attitude Survey, satisfaction is at an all-time low across different types of services. It's not just hospital waiting lists, it's general practice. But support for the core principles is, you know, rock solid, free at the point of use, primarily tax-funded, comprehensive. So the question is, well, first, will challenges with access diminish or fray the support on this for the model? But also, how do you draw on the public to try and get some consensus about the direction and the changes that need to happen? And when you get people in the room, we've done deliberative research with the public at the Health Foundation, they're able to have a very nuanced conversation about the NHS and its trade-offs, and will help you understand what's the right balance between, okay, reducing this waiting list, which is very long, but is only one part of the health system. So improving primary care as well and fixing social care. So one potential route to help make these more tricky changes stick is to be open and honest with the public and involve them in a conversation about the pace of change and what they can expect. We've got such a big gap at the moment between what the stated expectations for the system are for patients in terms of the waiting list, treatment times, which, you know, haven't been met for a decade, and the reality. So, yeah, one could be engaging the public in an honest conversation about what they can expect now, given the resources of the system, and what they'd prioritize over the long term.
Going back to what both of you talked about earlier, which is this guiding framework that it can at least give coherence to some of the underpinning levers that we were discussing. You talked about the previous sort of wave since the 1990, which was really largely market-style incentives in the public sector would ginger up performance, and that would be the main active ingredient for change alongside other bits and pieces like targets and performance management and so on, investment. Now, that's been and gone, hasn't it? It's almost totally faded to the point it's not an active ingredient anymore. But is anything taking its place? And should it?
We've got a funny mix right now, actually, because some of the people are back. They were around in the new Labour years. And some people who sort of wish they were there at the time seem to be around. So we've got things like targets and terror, league tables, a focus on expanding use of the private sector. We've got a sense that actually ICB should be going back to commissioning. And so you've got some of those ingredients of sort of new public management, market style incentives, choice being emphasized in some of the documents. So you've got a bit of it. And then you've got this sort of architecture that's been built over the last few years after the five-year forward view, the work in NHS England on new care models that has tried to emphasize collaboration. So organizations trying to work together to pool resources, identify shared priorities. The idea being that things like taking better care of people with complex conditions requires primary care to work with hospitals, to work with social care. So you sort of have those two together. And sometimes they can be quite an uncomfortable mix. So if you're being asked to collaborate, but you've also got a league table and you might get sacked if you fall towards the bottom of it, what are you supposed to do? Do you collaborate or do you compete? And where does one end and where does the other one start?
What you're describing, which is quite interesting, is that you've still got left-right axis in operation. So you've got the sort of neo-Bevanite still, you know, the system is a national system and should be run like that, collaboration or whatever, and very little competition. And then you've got a neo-Blairite, which is the, as you say, the new public management kind of competition choice left over from Reaganite Thatcher reforms. That still is a left-right axis, isn't it? More or less of the state. But then what is now inserting itself, I would say, is the technological change, which is not really a left-right axis. It's something quite different, and possibly even a kind of cultural change, perhaps, that we're seeing as well. Nigel, what do you think about this?
Who said that when the Bourbons came back after the French Revolution, they'd forgotten nothing and learned nothing? I have a slight feeling of dismay. Despite the rhetoric about thinking about what patients want, there's not enough focus on what you described as the boring detail. Right, the admin systems in many hospitals work very, very badly. They waste a lot of money. The appointment system, some GP practices are absolutely brilliant. In too many of them, however, they don't work properly. They create burnout in the GPs and they make the patients fed up. We're playing with things like new public management and targets and all these things. We're not actually focusing on the boring business of making things really at a micro level. And to be fair to the policymakers, that's because actually the tools available to actually positively make that happen are perhaps somewhat weak. And so they're focusing on big things which, like elective waiting, which are important. But I think the problem is that there's only so much bandwidth the system has got to make change. And you're throwing all these different methods at it. And it was a bit of the insight that the original Blair government had, which is you've really got to fix quite a lot of people's experience, both providers, the people, the staff and the patients, about their everyday experience of this. If you can fix that, you've then potentially got, A, people will have more time. You probably liberate some money. Second, quite a bit of that change can happen quite quickly, particularly now we've got this growth of really sophisticated software robots and you can use AI for the admin processes. So for example, in introducing ambient transcription in a consulting room, I talk to GP, just amazing. So you could do quite a bit that would show people that there was some hope. I mean, don't get me wrong, neighbourhood healthcare, ICBs, all of that, very keen on all of that. But there's a phasing and priorities question here. And I think giving people a message that actually where we really want you to focus on is changing the actual experience of people as they use the service on a daily basis. And every 4 weeks, I could show you an SPC chart that shows it's getting better.
I guess the question on the table is, if you look at all the morbidity tsunami that is ahead, particularly because people like us, baby boomers, are all getting to a certain age, and demography, is the iterative, pragmatic, stick to the knitting kind of change going to be fast enough to cope with, or are we just going to be overwhelmed if we take that ground up approach that you're suggesting?
But isn't this where we need to recognise the strengths of having an NHS that is centralised, where national government has a strong role and politics plays a strong role, to say there's these huge challenges of technology. There's this wave of technological development that risks moving far faster than our ability to govern it and steer it towards the right stuff. So we can say, look, let's take the opportunity of being this single payer system and say, let's try and steer this technology to what matters to us, managing complex multi-morbidity, trying to reduce health inequalities, trying to relieve the burden on frontline clinicians, and not just be a passive recipient of this stuff that people want to sell that is driven by the market, to actually shape the development. So I think there's a big opportunity. But what's the role of government now and the state investing in new technology and steering it to stuff that matters?
I agree with that. I suppose what I'm making an argument for is, let's create some space at the front line to make things better and make people feel better. You then should have time, resources, and goodwill that will allow you to perhaps do some of your bigger, cleverer things. And in the meantime, as Hugh's saying, central government can perhaps focus on the central bit, focus on things which it does well. And again, if you look internationally, that would be digital strategy, prevention strategy, and public health, thinking about how to deal with long-term conditions. So it's not an either or. It's about whether you dedicate our very limited resources, and also just politically and for other reasons, showing people that we can make a difference and that people make this effort and it pays off is quite important in a world where people increasingly feel kind of burnt out and there's a bit of feeling of hopelessness.
But to Nigel's point on what the centre can do and should do is health policy, not just the NHS. And that's the risk we've got at the moment, is that the big target for government on health at the moment and over the next 5 years is very narrowly defined around reducing the waiting list. We've got a 10-year plan for the NHS that's going to be developed by spring. Social care sort of been kicked into the long grass. I don't know what's happening on the wider health mission. I think what central government can uniquely do is say, how do we want to reduce health inequalities and improve the health of the population? And what are the interventions that we think are going to work, or we know work by looking back, things like Sure Start. And that's what we had in the 2000s with, alongside the NHS plan, we had a national health inequality strategy. It had some totemic social policy interventions. And over the long run, it seems to have made a difference. So the risk is the sort of the health policy of government is the NHS, is not about health. And we'll just get in a worse and worse situation in the NHS if we don't have that wider policy strategy for health inequalities around us. And I'm not sure where it is at the moment. And all the debate seems to be about waiting lists and hospitals.
The waiting lists, access issues, any waiting GP are the top of the public concern list, aren't they? And then maybe they're very couple things that Nigel is suggesting that they need to develop progress on to get cred for the longer term.
I agree with you. Like, if we can't get access to healthcare, the level of fear in the country, if you go to A&E, it's going to be 2 days. What does that do to a population over the long run? It's not good. But we can't just say, we'll do that first, and then we'll think about these wider issues because we'll never get there. So the question is, how do you make progress on access to hospital services, to general practice, and make meaningful progress while putting in place the longer term changes you need to improve health? I think if we say they're sequential, we never get onto the wider change that's needed.
So my last question then is, given all of that, just assume that you are the person holding the pen on this new long-term plan, what would be your top three things that you would do? I mean, including rip it up. Would it be 100 pages? Would it be 3 pages? What would you be doing now, given where we are, Nigel?
I think getting primary care really working, multidisciplinary, pluripotential primary care, a significant investment in the GP workforce, and a major focus on the factors that are causing burnout and general dismay in general practice, and then building the primary care system around that. And then actually, we got elements of that with the Fuller Review and a number of other things, but really sort of putting some gas in the tank to make that function, I think would be almost top of my list of things that we want to see. The second is we really have got to do something about the prevention and public health system. So really, again, supercharging the digital side of the system and getting that sorted out. And if I can have a fourth, I think the sort of long-term care, rehab and social care bit of this has to be in there. People say, well, we need to stop people going to the emergency department. Well, good luck with that. But and we can do that in the longer term. But in the shorter term, the problems that the public are experiencing and the hospital is experiencing are due to the fact that there's 14, 15% of the beds occupied by people who should be somewhere else. And we're doing a bad job on rehab more generally. And if we do the primary care bit of this, we can perhaps tick the box on getting more people back to work. We might have to do some mental health investment there as well. So we get a bit of a virtuous circle of more people in work, better general mental health and physical health. But the key to all of that, I think, has got to be a much stronger focus on the primary care system than we've seen today.
Thank you very much. And good to have the link with the workforce. Actually, mental health is the biggest issue, isn't it, with that? And in particular, young people's mental health, as it happens. Hugh?
I think I'd try and provide some hope, particularly for staff, that things are going to get better. So we know public satisfaction is low, but lots of staff are stressed out, burnt out. And I think need to see that there's going to be a way out of this. Their working lives will get better, get easier. Not easy to do, but I would really focus on trying to bring the staff with me and show that there's a direction where their working lives will improve. I think the second, I'd set some actual priorities. Nigel mentioned this earlier. The risk is the panel say everything will get better everywhere all at once, which is just nonsense. Improving primary care, I think, should be top of the list. The risk is that it's all about hospitals. And I think the third is I'd focus on what goes around the plan that's not about the NHS. I would bring forward plans to reform social care. I think that's happening way too slowly. And I'd put in place some aspirational long-term targets on reducing health inequalities and wider public policy that shapes health to show that this is not about the NHS just dealing with what's coming at it. You talked about rising multimorbidity. It's a positive vision for improving health, which the NHS is one part of.
Those are all very sensible from my perspective. I think the other thing I would foreground a little bit more is technology, and in particular, to try to go for some really promising demonstration programs across the system that can be done nationally with huge support, to at least show a glimmer of light of what might be possible. And to be able to do that properly, going back to Nigel's point, you really do need the clinicians on side. You need the welly to have the clinical, particularly the medic support. So we must leave it there. A big thank you to Nigel and Hugh for very sage insights into the 10-year plan, what might be ahead, what should be ahead. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Join us next month, where we will be returning to the issue of exposures in the environment and how they're affecting our health. This is a very, very interesting topic. A lot of you, I know, listened to the Rising Cancers, What's the Reason podcast late last year. It was very popular. So we're returning to risks in the environment that we are unaware of and what we should do about it. So join us in February for that. Meantime, a big thanks as ever to Leo and Sean at the Health Foundation, to Paddy and his team at Moll Productions. And it's goodbye from me until next time, Jennifer Dixon.